The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again. There's a week of school term left, so there's time to stack and stash all those Christmas presents before the holiday mayhem begins. We're devoting this podcast to books for the children and young people in your life. And if any of you adults attempted to switch off now, here's what a Tintin fan, Sleepless in Suffolk, had to say in response to a story about Hergé's boy reporter in this week's Guardian.
I wonder what Tintin would have done with the WikiLeaks. Certainly we'd all be better off if the state was more like Thompson and Thompson.
So be warned, the choices you make for your children will shape their frame of reference for the rest of their lives. But it's not all serious. In fact, I'm afraid we might be forced to be quite silly at times in this broadcast.
Hello, everybody. I'm Andy Stanton. And you're someone else.
The very cheerful Andy Stanton, who we'll be hearing much more of shortly. We'll also join a very lively discussion on our website about whether children's classics such as Baba the Elephant are too old-fashioned to be suitable for today's children. The poet and broadcaster Michael Rosen has something to say about that. And we'll be giving you our recommendations of what you might like to buy for your youngsters this Christmas. We'll be taking some tips from our Twitter followers. While with me in the studio to offer an expert's opinion is our children's books editor, Julia Eccleshare. So Julia, welcome. It's a while since the Guardian's Children's Fiction Prize gave you a chance to voice your opinions on this programme. Let's hear a little bit about what you have to recommend for this Christmas.
The first thing to look at is the gift book, since they are really published specifically for Christmas. And a book as a present is kind of a difficult thing. I mean, no child is going to be thrilled immediately, are they, by that square thing wrapped in paper. They'll know it's not more than a book. But once they open it, I think they're often surprised how much they get out of it. And I think as the giver of those presents, it's a bit like kind of going for the long game. You know it's not going to be the thing on the day that gets the most use, but it may be the thing that they go back to time and time again. So I would always recommend giving a book, but I think you have to think quite carefully about making it attractive on the day as well as that long-term thing. So for the very youngest, I would go for Raymond Briggs's Mother Goose Treasury, which is a reissue, but it is such a classic title. They've unfortunately cut it down. I think they think children can need to know fewer rhymes than they used to. But it just is an introduction to all the best of those simple English clapping, jiggling, repetitive rhymes that you can't remember properly, and it's really nice to have them as reference to share with the baby on your knee. Mm-hmm. And everybody with a baby needs to have that in their house. It's just a kind of Bible. It goes along with.
Yeah, that's a good tip for parents who might not have yet learnt what they need to look out for. I mean, there's that new parenting stage, isn't there, where you don't have a clue what sort of.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't know what it is that you know, if you see what I mean. But once you get a book like this, you remember that you did know all of those rhymes and somebody did them with you. It's just wonderful to be reminded of them again. And the illustrations are fantastic. And you have to have it in your library.
So what about slightly older children?
Well, then I would move up to, there's a very, very nice new edition of Aesop's Fables, which is retold by Fiona Waters and illustrated by Fulvio Testa. And the thing about Aesop's Fables is that, again, they're all the things that you know, the things like the hare and the tortoise. Think how often you come up with those stories, those kind of moral tales, which explain why it is that you have to be kind or you shouldn't be too big for your boots or any of those sorts of stories. Very simple. And the thing about this edition is that the illustrations and the retellings are very fresh. You wouldn't know that these tales were hundreds and thousands of years old. You just think they were wonderful tales written for you, and they're very short to read at bedtime. That's another great plus of them.
Are we getting a bit more conservative, do you think? These are retellings.
No, we've always had retellings. We have to have these stories retold time and time and time again, because each new generation forgets that they need an edition of them. So no, I'm a huge believer in all those stories being passed down, because actually that's the sort of accretion which new stories come off. And I spend a lot of my life thinking about whether I'm the hare or the tortoise, or I think it's a very important thing to have. So I would want every child to have access to those stories. So I'm all for new editions.
Now, you've got one here that really appeals to me, Amazing Pop-Up Machines. That would presumably be good for boys.
Yeah, this is a great book for boys of 6+. Robert Crowther, who was a sort of master of pop-ups. And this is a lovely one called Pop-Up Machines. machines, and you open it out and up comes a huge, beautiful, hefty, whacking great machine. But there's also a sort of information box, and then what's particularly nice is a little make it kit. So you can make an additional thing like a block of concrete, which the machine can then lift up. So it's a sort of book and toy.
So when you said at the beginning that a square thing isn't necessarily the most exciting thing to find under the Christmas tree, this might be an antidote to the square thing.
Exactly. This is a way of finding something that's lovely on the day, but also will give a lot of value afterwards. So yeah, I mean, a square thing doesn't have to be boring, but I do think that most children don't think that the book is the best present, usually. So then I would go for, again, in the same sort of area of something that's more than a book, I'd go for Alienology in the very successful Templarology series, which is kind of curious mix of fiction and fact. Obviously, with aliens, there aren't actually a lot of facts, but there are some facts and a lot of fiction, and it's presented in a fantastic way. So, I mean, you'd lose a child for a lot of time on Christmas Day with a book like that, because they really would want to open the little booklets that are the additionality and pull out the things that you can pull out and pop them back in their slots. You might end up with some pieces on the floor, that's the only thing. But it would be a great occupation for Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm. Let's just move now to some of the books that have been recommended by our Twitter followers. We have somebody called Agiati, excuse me if I've mispronounced your avatar, who's recommending Persephone, A Journey from Winter to Spring. Tell us about that.
Well, that's fantastic. And Sally Pom Clayton is a wonderful storyteller. This is the story of Persephone, who, you know, in the Greek myths, and it's the story of from winter to spring. And again, like Aesop's stories, these are stories we need to know, and we need to keep telling them to our children. We can't think that our stories only begin now. Yeah. They do go back into the past.
And it's quite nice. Agiati says, I am Greek and loving it. So are my three little ones. Mm. Another one, Leeds Book Club urge us to go for scary. They're particularly keen on the Green No series. Lucy M. Boston. Now, I don't know of this series.
Oh, well, the Green Nose series. I wouldn't really call them scary. I would call them very benign fantasy. But there is some scary stuff in it. But they were set in a wonderful house, which actually exists just outside Huntingdon. They are ghostly, and they are a fantastic... Well, they're just a kind of way of life. You get into them, and you will read the whole series through. And there's just about to be, just before Christmas, a new TV series written by no less than Downton Abbey's Julian Fellowes.
Oh, so, brilliant. So that raises 2 points, doesn't it? One is that kids do love things that have series, so you can read another one. And the other thing is television.
It will be reinforced by seeing it on the television, but you could have got to it first by having it in that present already for them. So they might have seen it on telly just before Christmas, and then you've got the book.
And now we've also had a couple of librarians who've tweeted suggestions. Library Mice says she would give Noah Barleywater Runs Away. Tell us about Noah Barleywater.
Well, Noah Barleywater Runs Away is by... John Boyne, who of course wrote The Boyne Striped Pyjamas, for which he had incredible success. But don't think about that when you think about Noah Barleywater, because Noah Barleywater is a wonderful modern fable about a boy who runs away from home and sets off an adventure, and he meets a strange storytelling toy maker. And older readers will know that the toy maker is somebody else, but that doesn't come out till later. But it is a very, very good modern fable.
So, now let's go to one of our jolliest authors, first winner of the Roald Dahl Funny Prize, and the happy deviser of one of the most successful current series of children's books, and it's about The Disgusting Mr. Gunn. He's, of course, Andy Stanton, and he's been talking to Michelle Pawley. But here, first, is a reading from his latest, Mr. Gunn and the Secret Hideout.
Mr. Gunn was a fierce old blister with a face as angry as 1,000 walnuts, and a big red beard which smelt of menace and beer. He hated children, animals, fun, comics, pop music, birthday parties, books, Christmas, the seaside, computer games, people called Colin, Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays. Actually, it would probably be quicker to tell you what he liked instead. What he liked was snoozing in bed all day, being a horror, and secret hideouts. And the secret hideout he was in right now was the best secret hideout he had ever seen. "This secret hideout's flipping brilliant," shouted Mr. Gunn as he paced up and down in his hobnail boots. "It's got everything. Rats, cockroaches, pipes what keep dripping slime everywhere, and it stinks. It's like what I always imagined heaven would be. And best of all, no one's ever going to find us here." "Yeah," agreed Mr. Gum's dreadful accomplice, a scrawny butcher by the name of Billy William III. Billy was standing by a grey iron furnace, shovelling old bits of meat onto the flames. And not just any old bits of meat, but the stalest, grubbiest, most appalling specimens imaginable. Strings of ancient entrails, withered old horse legs, rubbery turkey necks. On they all went, onto the flames. Billy was covered in soot and he was dripping with gobs of hot fat, but he hardly noticed. And why? I don't know, I'm not him, he just didn't. "Faster!" commanded Mr. Gum, hopping from one foot to the other like an unstoppable quail. "Shovel them entrails, Billy, me boy. Chuck it on, and stoke it all up with coal or I'll bash you."
"Right you are, Gummy, me old rattler," laughed Billy, chucking on a piece of coal that was twice the size of a piece of coal that was half the size of the piece of coal I'm talking about.
"Roar!" bellowed the furnace. A great long lick of flame flicked out and singed off Billy's eyebrows, cruel as a scarlet donkey.
"Ha ha ha," cackled Billy, who loved to see people getting hurt. "Someone just got their eyebrows burned off."
Then he realised who that someone was, and he let out a blood-curdling howl.
"Ow!" yelled Billy, hopping up and down in agony. "How come I gotta do all the shovelling round here anyway? How come you ain't doing none?" "Shut up!" roared Mr. Gum, whacking Billy over the head with a silk handkerchief.
He didn't have a silk handkerchief, so he used a cricket bat instead.
"We gotta keep getting that power up. We can't afford to rest for a moment. Now, you carry on shovelling. I gotta rest for a moment."
Mr. Gum threw himself down on a filthy old sofa he'd found on a rubbish tip, all covered with stains and moss. The cushions were cold and soggy, and a big rusty spring poked uncomfortably into his back, but Mr. Gum was such a laser he didn't really care.
"I tell you, I love this secret hideout," yawned Mr. Gum as he lay there staring up at the ceiling, his hands behind his head, and his head behind whatever was in front of his head, probably just a bit of air or something. "This is the life, eh, Billy?"
"Yeah, this is the life," said Billy.
"Yeah, this is the life," said another voice.
"Who the blimmin' flip said that?"
shouted Mr. Gum.
"It was I," cried a man, jumping out from behind the sofa. "I'm surprising Ben. I pop up here, I pop up there. Surprise, surprise, I'm everywhere."
And off he ran, giggling like a packed lunch.
Thank you very much, Andy. That was deliciously disgusting. I've got some questions to ask you, but we also have some questions from our Young Guardian Books panel, and I think we're going to kick off with one of those.
Neve Arthur, age 8. Who or what inspired your characters and why?
Hi, my name is Mila and I am 10 years old. My questions for Andy are, what interested you to be a writer? And also, how did you create the character Mr. Gum? Was it a family member or a friend or just in your head?
I started off writing the first book and I didn't know what I was going to write and I didn't really know where it was going to go. So I thought, what can I have to make an exciting story happen? And I thought, maybe if I invent a villain, something will happen. Because villains never just sit around, not even Mr. Gum, who's really lazy. They never just sit around. They're always up to no good. So that a plot always happens if you start off with a villain, I think. So that was my first idea. I thought, I'll have a villain. What will my villain be like? Really stupid, really stinky, like an old-fashioned tramp from the 1920s, because that makes me laugh. So the first idea was to have a villain, and then secondly, okay, how can I dress him up? Stupid and stinky. And that's how Mr. Gum came along. He's not like anyone I know, luckily. As for my other characters, they just sort of turn up as I need them. I thought, if Mr. Gum's got a friend, what will he be like? He's going to be really disgusting as well. And then Billy William III, this horrible butcher, popped up. And then when I was writing the first book, about halfway through, I thought, I better have a kid in this book, because it's a kid's book. And all my other characters have just been horrible, disgusting old men. So I thought, I better have a little girl. And that's how Polly popped up, and she's sort of my favourite. So I just invent the characters as I need them. They seem to walk along into the plots at the right time, which is nice of them. And what inspired me to write a book in the first place? Well, I always love reading books so much. If anyone's listening out there who doesn't read, read! Thank you. And I always like reading books so much. I used to walk around with my head in a book all the time. I still do, actually.
As Mila said there, her whole class loves your books. We know that kids find them hilarious. You've won the first ever Roald Dahl Funny Prize. You've also won the Blue Peter Award for most fun book with pictures. But you're clearly a grown man. How do you know what children are going to find funny?
I might look like a grown man, but I may have the mind of an 8-year-old. I don't know, really. I find kids funny. I like talking to kids. They're hilarious. If it makes me laugh, and I would have liked it when I was 8 years old, I put it in. I suppose I have a connection with, or I can remember what it was like to be 8 or 9 years old and what I used to laugh at. And also, I think, I'll tell you the other thing, I think kids get a lot more humour than people think they do. Because people always say, kids love repetition, don't they? But adults like repetition, don't they, too? Adults like repetition, don't they, too? See, it's funny. It's always funny. And there's loads of sketch shows for adults, like Little Britain, that's got lots of repetition in it.
But there's a lot more than repetition to your books. There's the surreal humour, and there's the wordplay as well.
Well, kids like that as well. Kids like the sound of words, and just like adults do. Every word is funny if you say it long enough. Grapefruit, that's a funny word. Grapefruit, 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 grapefruit. I like stupid words. Grapefruit, robot, uncle, that's a good word. And I think kids, you know, they like the sound of words as well. Words are very musical. And I think kids like that. And silly names as well. Because can I do Polly's full name for you? Because Polly, if anyone doesn't know, and if anyone does know, the little heroine in the stories is called Polly. She's 9 years old. But her full name goes like this. Jammy, Grammy, Lammy, for Hupper, Berlin, Stereo, EO, EO, Leb, Siep, Neuromonica, Lestrapec, De Grespin, De Crespin, De Spespin, De Vespin, De Whoop, De Loop, De Brunkle, Merry Christmas, Lenoir. So everyone calls her Polly for short.
Right, and can I just point out that you weren't actually reading that? That just came direct.
Yeah, I've said that quite a few times in my career. There are kids, when I go and do events at schools and festivals, there are kids who know the whole thing off by heart. Sometimes drag them onto stage and make them do it in front of 500 people. They get it perfectly right. Very scary. Instead of doing their homework, that's what they're doing. They're learning Polly's full name. So I'm bringing down the educational system as well.
Andy Stanton. I was particularly struck by his phrase, giggling like a packed lunch. That clearly comes from an 8-year-old part of his brain, Julia, doesn't it?
I think he has a lot of 8-year-old parts of in his brain.
Is it easier to win over children if you're a laugh?
Oh, yes. I mean, obviously, that's a very good first way in, isn't it? I mean, you know, if the book is going to be entertaining and they can see that immediately, that's a great appealing factor.
Now, Phil Ardar, who judged this year's Roald Dahl Funny Prize, complained in The Guardian about what he called the Gruffalo effect. What does he mean?
He wasn't really exactly complaining, but what he was saying is that if you have the best-selling picture book by many, many miles, the best-selling book is the Gruffalo, but all of Julia's books sell very well.
That's Julia Donald's.
And they sell very well because they are written, or one of the reasons is because they're written in rhyming couplets. And she is just unbelievably good at it. She does it very well, and she does it very wittily. The problem is that everybody is trying to do the same. And a lot of people can't write very well, can't write very wittily, and can't scan, which is actually the most infuriating thing because you can't even read them aloud. What Phil was saying was that the problem is that we have a lot of lookalikes which aren't actually funny or light or good in any way, but are forcing the thing along because the rhymes make it sound like it's going to be entertaining, but actually it isn't.
Now, moving up an age group, the winner of the older section of the Funny Prize was Louise Renison with a book that excruciatingly titled Withering Tights. She specialises in these absurd titles, doesn't
actually,
she?
Withering Tights, if you read the book, is the most brilliant title for it. Obviously, it's a pastiche of Wuthering Heights, but it also fits in with her whole Georgia Nicholson character. It is a laugh a minute. I mean, she is incredibly, incredibly entertaining.
There's another comedy writer who's just come back with a new series, who's Roz Asquith, who did The Teenage Warrior, which was very popular a few years ago, wasn't it?
Well, this time she's gone for a slightly younger age group, and this is Letters from an Alien Schoolboy. And yes, it is very funny, because what it allows you to do, I mean, think about humour. I mean, Michael Rosen, in his speech, he invented the Roald Dahl Funny Prize, and at his speech this year, he said he thought there were too many mentions of underpants, and that were underpants really that funny, whereupon the whole audience fell about laughing. So clearly, they do think underpants are funny. But jokes come in all sorts of ways, and that's one obvious one. But what's a very good thing to do in humour is using the humour as a way of looking at us as a society. And the thing that's good about Letters from an Alien Schoolboy is that there are lots of jokes about perfectly ordinary things that we do, but if you view it from an alien's point of view, of course they look utterly ridiculous. There's a wonderful bit about small talk, for example. I mean, all the things that are perfectly normal, if you look at it from an outsider's point of view, and the humour's a great way into that. You couldn't just write a story and keep saying, isn't this funny, nudge, nudge. You'd have to be keep poking the reader. As it is, if you get the outsider voice, you just keep the whole ball in the air all the time. And it's great and very good fun to read. And the illustrations are fantastic.
Very good. Now, you mentioned Michael Rosen, and he has been involved in a bit of a discussion this week on our website about Baba. Now, we all have children's books that we regard with nostalgia because they were our favourites when we were young. But are some of them imprinting unhealthy values on our children? This is exactly the issue that Mike raised in a conversation on Christmas reading. And here's a flavour of the discussion.
Consider, naked elephant arrives in city and learns how to dress to acquire the trappings of civilization, which he takes back to his brethren back in Africa, who then proceed to get dressed and imitate human, i.e. Parisian, characteristics, etc., etc.
I'm not sure small children necessarily do pick up the colonial message in Baba, but I'm sure it's there. I bet if you said to a four-year-old, do you think that it's good that Baba became king, or should elephants wear clothes, she would say yes.
But so many 20th century children's classics have negative historical messages, which children certainly do pick up on, and it doesn't help them if one censors their books altogether. Fair enough, some are terrible and have no place on children's bookshelves.
As a huge Tintin fan in my early years, I was too naive to notice the constant prejudicial racial undertones. What can I say? I love the character, still do, happy endings, etc.
But exposure to Baba and Father Christmas is not going to turn any little boys or girls into racists or oppressors.
Now, Mike, I have to confess that I have a copy of Little Black Sambo, which has been sitting in my cupboard all the way through my children's childhood, and I never actually read it to them, but I have a great affection for it.
Well, our problem is, we're talking as white people here, we don't actually know what effect these things had, right? We heard one of the posters there saying, well, it wouldn't have turned me into a little racist. The great problem is about this attitudinal stuff, which is what we're talking about, is we don't actually know. Because the whole argument about racism is that we are positioned, in this particular case, as far as white people are concerned, in a particular relationship with the other. The other is determined for us when we're very, very young as being black, as being uncivilized or being savage or any of these things with these old books. And I'm 64, so I read these things when I was very young. I don't know to what extent I was positioned to think of these people as less than me, because I was never exposed to a voice where that person, those other people, could speak with their own voices back. That's the whole point about post-colonialism. This is the point that Chinua Achebe makes, that until he wrote Things Fall Apart, the people who are described by the white people had never described their own experiences in that form, the novel, the children's book, and even in film.
Now, Julia, Baba, would you give Baba to children now?
Yes, because I love it, but I think Michael's point is absolutely right in the sense that if we believe, as we do, that children learn an awful lot of very good values from children's books, we can't then suddenly say they don't learn these negative values. It's an incredibly important point. And we may not think that we're seeing people in this prejudicial way, but we are. And that must go down in our consciousness.
So, Mike, let's get down to basics. Would you give Baba to your children or your grandchildren?
I have done. I have read Baba. And I think it gives us one way in which we can talk about these things.
Yes,
right?
So
a book doesn't begin and end with a book.
No.
There's a whole load of stuff before it, you read the book, and there's a whole lot of stuff afterwards. And, you know, the first couple of times, maybe you might not say very much, and then you might bring in other kinds of books. So my children, for example, go to a school where Black History Month is taken very, very seriously, and a lot of stuff. My little five-year-old sat there this morning telling me all about Mary Seacole. Now, this has been told in the school by black people, and it is about Mary Seacole. So already there's people talking from the position that prior to this present era hasn't been described by black people themselves. He said to me, she didn't get, so it's a five-year-old talking to me, he said she couldn't get the job that she wanted. She couldn't get to be a nurse because in those days black people weren't allowed to be. Now, alongside Baba, alongside other things, this all goes into the mixer. In my day, there was no mixer. That voice that told about Mary Seacole to five-year-olds, six-year-olds, seven-year-olds, a totally accessible story, we never heard that. All we heard about was Florence Nightingale, end of.
Mm. But the thing is, Michael, I mean, one of the reasons that people are worried about these books being out there, and one of the reasons Baba, for example, has been edited down, hasn't it? Because the savages, if you remember when Barbara and Celeste go on their honeymoon, the spread where they see those savages, as they're thought of in the books, has been deleted. And if you look at something like Dr. Doolittle, which is incredibly prejudiced, they've edited all of that down because for many children, there is never going to be that. The book does just stand on its own. And so you then you go away with those images and there's no discussion.
But it raises a question as well, whether actually they're better now that they are part of a bigger discussion, a more recent discussion. I mean, we're not going to go back to the place that the colonial children of the 30s were when they were reading Brunhoff.
The problem is with the younger child, and it's the problem of these things, of course, going into homes or places where there isn't any kind of discussion or mediation. I totally take Julia's point. I mean, the weird thing about Barbar is that if you remember, the hierarchy goes... The lady, the old lady, who is the kind of epitome of civilization, Barbar, who is like the next character down because he learned civilization. Then there's the animals, the elephants below that, who Barbar has to civilize. Then there may be, you could argue, there's the rhinoceroses, who the elephants defeat very easily by painting silly things on their bums. And then below that are the black people of wherever Barbar is supposed to be coming from. Mm. So in actual fact, black people are below the level of rhinoceroses. Mm. I mean, that's the awful thing.
But there's nothing wrong with rhinoceroses. We love rhinoceroses.
Well, indeed. Well, that whole, I mean, the whole issue, I mean, you could argue that the problem with Barbar is not just simply and only the representation of Africa as some sort of strange, savage Eden that needs to be civilized by Parisian virtues, but also the notion of hierarchy and the idea that, of course, there's a king, which is quite ironic coming from France, which, after all, you know, got rid of their kings, that the kingship is fine, that Celeste is at one rung below the king because, after all, he takes Celeste to be his bride. And so that the hierarchies are reinforced. I mean, I think for young children, in some ways, that's as powerful a message that comes from Barbar as any other, that the hierarchies are natural.
Now let's move forward and talk about some of the titles that haven't dated so much. Now, Julia, we've got some more recommendations for our tweeters. Perhaps we could join a conversation with them.
Carnief from Canada says, "Oh, The Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss is a must."
I don't know that one.
Well, I mean, Dr. Seuss, he's always going to find readers because he's got great sense of humour. But I'm sure, Michael, in Dr. Seuss, there's some pretty prejudicial things, aren't there?
Are there?
He desperately tried to combat prejudice. You know, very clearly in Horton Hears a Who and The Yertle and the Turtle, whatever it's called, those are very much anti-prejudicial. You know, everybody sits on top of the tiniest little turtle and, you know, there's environmental messages and all the rest of it. I mean, the last one, that The Places You'll Go, that's really his farewell. What he'd done was because he kept getting invited to college campuses on the graduation days. And so he wanted to send a message out about The Places You Go. If you start at the other end of his career with The Things You'll See on Mulberry Street, there's a little bit of kind of old-style colonial attitudes in The Things You'll See on Mulberry Street before he got into the swing of his main rhymes. But by and large, after The Things You'll See on Mulberry Street, his message is that if you're prejudiced against the little guy, then, you know, you are either bad or you'll get it in your in the neck yourself.
Now, there are a couple of other recommendations. Susan Cooper, particularly, and Rosemary Sutcliffe.
Well, Susan Cooper, Dark is Rising Sequence. And, of course, fantasy, I mean, often, if so long as it isn't carrying too much of a sort of message against some kind of colonial message, which they can carry. But in The Dark is Rising, and I would say the same of Alan Garner's fantasy, they have lasted very well. And I think fantasy is pretty safe territory for that. Eagle of the Ninth, well, I mean, that's just a classic historical story. But of course, you know, Rosemary Sutcliffe was the absolute best of the writer of about the past in that kind of way. But then her view of the Romans was very particular, and her view of ancient Britain. And I'm sure...
Has it dated well, aged well?
For me, it's fine, yes. But I read it as a child.
Shall we talk subtexts there?
Which yes.
Is, I mean, maybe they're perceptible to children, maybe not. Let's take The Dark is Rising. You know, the key issue with fantasy books, this was raised by dear old George W. Bush and the Axis of Evil, wasn't it? That when George W. Bush said there's an Axis of Evil, and of course the converse of that is that he was in an Axis of Good, was that some people said that George W. Bush seems to live in the kind of world of the fantasy book for children. Namely, there are good guys and bad guys, and then that is how the world is. Whereas, as we know, classically in the adult novel, you know, some people who are good also have bad bits, and bad people have good bits, and our hero, whoever it might be, Pip or doesn't matter who, you know, Miss Bennett, heading through the world, discovers goodnesses and badnesses, and this is some kind of a moral struggle, either in the individual or in the characters. And the problem with fantasy for children, goes the argument, is that you reduce the world to goodies and baddies, and then of course you end up with a George W. Bush division of the world. So some people will say that there is a kind of inherent conservatism in most fantasy forms. When it comes to Rosemary Sutcliffe, the interesting thing here is when she wrote it, you know, here is the decline of the Roman Empire at the very same time as, guess what's happening, the British Empire is declining. So some people say, isn't there a strange and interesting nostalgia going on here about loss of empire? And that somewhere or another written into this is this sense that a loss of empire is a bad thing, and that is written into the subtext of the book. Now, there's not a, probably a 10-year-old alive who would pick that up as a message, but in our kind of adult critical way, it might be something that's quite interesting to contemplate. I mean, as a book, I adored it as a kid. I read it contemporaneously with The Loss of Empire and when Rosemary Sutcliffe brought it out and when it was broadcast on Children's Hour, BBC Radio, and I used to dash back from school in order to hear it because I found it so powerful and interesting. So it's not that I'm rejecting it, but it's quite interesting to put in its context.
Yeah, no, there's lots to think about there. And it's also pointing back to the importance of books being something that are talked about and discussed and read out loud, isn't it, Julia?
Yeah, it is. But the context is a very important point because all books are published. When they are published, they are going to reflect the issues of that time. But as you say, we've also got to look at it as whether it's a story that still works and is still something that will excite and stimulate children.
And I think that Susan and Rosemary Sutcliffe will be exciting and stimulating children for years to come. Thanks to all of you who tweeted your suggestions. You can leave more on our podcast page. And if you've come to us through iTunes, that's on guardian.co.uk/books. Now, Mike, I would just like you to leave us with one of my favourite little verses ever, which comes from We're Going on a Bear Hunt. Can you just read it to read us out?
I just can't think how it goes. I wonder if it goes like this. We're going on a bear hunt. We're going to catch a big one. What a beautiful day. We're not scared. Uh-oh. Grass. Long, wavy grass. We can't go over it. We can't go under it. Oh, no. We got to go through it. Swish.
Oh, what better place to hand over to the very adult Richard Lee to tell us what's coming up in the week ahead.
Yes, we're not scared, but on next week's podcast we'll be deep in the thick, oozy mud of contemporary slang as Lindsay Irvin talks to Jonathan Green about the countercultural joys of street speech. Also on the site we'll be rounding up the votes for our books of the year and continuing our series of season's readings. The festive feeling continues in tomorrow's Guardian Review, where our critics pick out the books to put under the tree for the adults in your life, whether they're into sport, poetry, food, or fiction. And on Sunday, the Observer's new review will be looking back on some of the voices we've lost this year. Beryl Bainbridge is remembered by her daughter, Jojo Davis, while legendary New Yorker editor Lillian Ross remembers J.D. Salinger.
We also have an early Christmas present to send off to two winners of our Patti Smith Just Kids competition. Signed copies are now winging their way to Andrew F. Wilson and Carol Green. For this week, though, thanks to Michael Rosen, thanks to Julia Eccleshare, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and our producer is Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.